Makeshift Stories presents Somewhere, Sometime, an irregular series of short sci-fi and fantasy stories.
Our first radio transmission started over 100 years ago, so in theory, any intelligence within 100 light years might be able to hear us. In reality, that far away, our signals are probably almost indistinguishable from the background noise of the universe. But what about closer in, at, say, only a dozen or two light years distance? Could they hear us, and what would they be listening to? And if they left their homeworld expecting to find the new wave sounds of the 80s when they arrived here, would they be disappointed to discover that their favorite bands had been relegated to the sale bins of the last remaining record stores? In this month's story, Orman, an untalented musician of dubious origin, on tour in Orbit City, New Mexico, meets Garth, the curator of a local space museum, during one of her performances. Garth, a wannabe astronaut, decides to take Orman to the city's unofficial attraction, the landfill, where decades ago, thousands of unwanted video game cartridges are supposed to be buried. He thinks the musician is not what she claims to be, and is only in town to dig up some ancient game cartridges to sell to collectors. But the truth is far different than he suspects. We now invite you to sit back and relax as you listen to Makeshift Stories 81, An Alien Adventure. Somewhere in some time, one person's garbage may turn out to be another's treasure.
Smoke drifted leisurely through the rundown bar, making the view from the tiny stage, wedged into the farthest point from the door, smudgy at best. Glare from the spotlights added to the poor visibility, obscuring the mostly empty tables. Out of the glare, off to one side, Orman could almost make out the faces of a few locals, huddling around their drinks, trying to talk over her music. The haze smelt like a million campfires and extended out into the streets, then into the mountains, where wildfires perpetually ate away at the edge of the mostly abandoned town. Orman turned up the music on her amp, then launched into a half-hearted rendition of the King's Suspicious Minds. The nostalgic opening chords appeared to resonate with the locals, and they stopped talking for a moment, almost noticing Orman before they delved back into an intense conversation, which was the best response, actually the only response, she had solicited from an audience since Orman had started her Southwest tour. 20 towns in 35 days, and Orman was only on day 19, which meant that this was Orbit City, New Mexico, and the T-minus 10 bar. The town was home to the Museum of Space History, and little else these days. Most of Orbit City's population had fled in the previous decade when the water ran out and the fires, fed by leaking fumes from an old fracking operation, had started. But the town was her ultimate destination, the real goal of her tour, cleverly hidden in the almost random selection of gigs. Orman belted out the last words of her song in her best faux baritone, to sporadic, unenthusiastic clapping. One set of hands energetically stood out. The youngest man in the group of locals, wearing threadbare army surplus pants and a camel t-shirt, jumped up.
"Encore! Encore!"
His voice, muted by the smoke, barely reached the stage before the man's friends pulled him back down, like crabs in a bucket on a dock, preventing one of their fellow inmates from escaping to make sure that they would all share the same fate. Orman politely bowed, and that's when she noticed another person, a man or a woman, she couldn't tell which, sitting alone in the shadows in a booth near the washrooms.
Thank you very much.
Still thrown by the sight of the lone stranger, Orman trembled slightly as she spoke. With the echo effect still on, her voice bounced around the nearly empty bar, making it feel cavernous, and Orman totally alone.
"And that's it for tonight. Thank you, Orbit City. I'm the Queen of Rock and Roll, and I'm here until Saturday night. Tell your friends to come down and party to your favorite tunes from the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Orman checked the booth near the washroom again. This time it was empty, which didn't surprise her. A lone stranger had shown up every night she had played in the last 10 towns. He or she would come in near the middle of her final set, then leave after her cover of Suspicious Minds.
"They're different people every night. You're connecting dots where there's nothing to connect,"
Orman told herself without much conviction, as there was good reason to suspect that someone might be tracking her. She pushed the thought out of her mind and turned her amps off with a pop, put a dust cover over her nearly obsolete keyboards, then stepped down off the stage to take up residence at one of the less desirable tables that the staff of the T-10 had set aside for performers. She had just started to dig into a half-eaten clubhouse sandwich when the man in the army surplus pants, the one who had stood up to clap, came up and hovered over the table.
"Hi, Queen of Rock and Roll. I'm Garth."
Ormond looked up with a mouthful of sandwich, quickly swallowed, wiped her mouth with the back of her hand, like she had seen in the movies, then motioned for Garth to sit down.
"Ormond. My name is Ormond,"
she choked out.
"I haven't heard of a woman called Ormond before," Garth noted. "But then again, I've never heard a woman with a vocal range to do a Presley imitation either. Where are you from, Ormond?"
It was one question that she didn't have a bad answer for, so she replied with what she thought would explain her accent, her unusual name, and curtail any additional questions.
"I'm from Canada."
"Wow, that's cool. I grew up in North Bay, Ontario. Don't get many Canadians down here."
Ormond quickly redirected the conversation.
"So, Garth, what brought you to Orbit City?"
"Huh, space, of course," he quickly responded with a small chuckle. "I've always loved space and wanted to be an astronaut when I was young. But there's not much chance of that these days, unless you're Chinese or Indian."
Ormond gave the man a questioning look.
"Oh, I got a job as curator at the museum in town here. We specialize in artifacts from the early space program. The first atomic test was not far from here. I bet you didn't know that. Most people don't. The area's a pretty important part of mid-20th century history. If you've got time, come over to the museum tomorrow and I can show you around."
"Thanks for the kind offer,"
Ormond politely replied.
"Unfortunately, I'm not a space buff, but I'm going to poke around the town, and if I end up at the museum, I'll be sure to drop in."
Unable to conceal his excitement, Garth smiled.
"I'm off at noon. I could show you our town's most infamous site, the landfill."
"Landfill?"
Ormond questioned, feeling her hearts begin to pound.
"You know, the landfill where the vid games were buried in 83. I know the exact location. One of the local kids..."
Garth pointed back to his friends at the table, then corrected himself.
"Well, he's not a kid anymore. He's got to be over 60 now. But he won't tell anyone his real age. Anyway, he brought me a cartridge he had pilfered from the site when he was 12, before it was sealed up. Showed me the exact location where he had found the thing, and made me swear to keep it a secret."
"Actually, I'd be interested in seeing that."
Without thinking, Ormond blurted out.
"Oh, you're a gamer then. I wouldn't have guessed. You don't look the type."
"No, I'm not a gamer. I'm just interested in pop culture history. I wrote a paper on the causes of the 1983 game industry crash in grad school."
"So music is a sideline?"
"An interest in history doesn't pay the bills, so one has to do whatever it takes."
Ormond shrugged.
"I understand. Being a wannabe astronaut doesn't pay either. Come to the museum at 1. See you then."
Garth got up and walked back to his table, with a little bounce to his step, like he had just won a bet with his pals. Ormond grimaced. Normally, she avoided situations like this. Getting involved with locals was always a risky tactic, but she needed a guide. She didn't have much time. The tour had taken longer to set up than the plan allowed for, and the longer she was here, the more exposed she became. Avoiding the cones of light from street lamps, Ormond walked the 4 blocks back to her motel, pausing frequently in the shadows to ensure that no one was following her. Aside from a few ancient 4x4s chugging noisily through the town, the street appeared to be deserted. When she arrived at the front door, she checked again, then walked in, and waited until she was sure the night clerks weren't watching her, then sauntered through the shabby motel lobby and out the back. Tonight, on the verge of finally completing her mission, she had recklessly decided to afford herself a luxury. Ormond walked into the desert behind the hotel and over a small hill. When she was far enough away so that no one could see her, Ormond made an invisible signal to the sky. What she didn't notice was the lone figure who had followed her at a discreet distance, crouching behind a shrub. Precisely at noon, after spending the morning wandering through the town, Armin arrived at the Space Museum. The facility consisted of a blocky concrete and glass structure on the edge of town, nestled into the rolling foothills. A permanent firebreak that surrounded the city bulged out to envelop the building and adjacent grounds. The site was littered with rusting relics from the early space age. Armin smiled at their naive simplicity. The midday sun baked the cracked asphalt through the choking haze of nearby fires, making the heat almost unbearable, even for her, so she was sweating by the time she pushed through the glass doors and into the dark air-conditioned foyer beyond. One side of the modest space was taken up by the obligatory souvenir shop. To Armin's surprise, there were a few tourists picking through its ancient dusty stock.
"Hey, Armin!"
Garth enthusiastically called as he emerged from the main exhibit hall. As the door closed, Armin could see a well-worn Martian landscape behind him.
"Do you want to look around? Although they're a bit dated, we've got some great exhibits here. They were first class in their day. We could walk on the surface of Mars or experience a space launch."
"Maybe later. Like I told you last night, space isn't my thing."
"Hey, no problem. Well, let's go then, shall we? Let's go see Orbit City Shrine to early video games."
The ridges of the mountains scrolled by like a parallax landscape in a cartoon as they drove south to the old city landfill site. The landfill, in disuse for over half a century, was almost indistinguishable from the scrubby desert around it. Only an old abandoned concrete structure, a few decidedly artificial mounds, and a small sign indicated that they were there. Garth slowed and turned into a heavily rutted dirt road, which quickly proved to be too much for his small electric car. He pulled off and parked in the shade of a nearby row of dying Rio Grande cotton trees. He turned off the ignition, then turned to Orman and smiled.
"Well, I hope you brought a hat. Sorry, but we've got to hoof it from here. The place we're looking for is about a quarter mile up this trail."
As they walked along the road, avoiding the potholes, the mounds resolved into rough flat-top piles which poked out of the sand like ruins in some post-apocalyptic landscape.
"About 10 years ago, the town wanted to turn this place into a national monument, but couldn't get anyone to fund it,"
Garth casually noted, trying to make conversation. Armin, distractedly looking around, tripped on a broken toilet bowl that was sticking partway out of the ground. She picked herself up, knocking the dust off her pants.
"Well, that makes sense. Certainly doesn't look like a place of national significance. Which mound are the game cartridges buried in?"
"They're not in the mounds. The company felt that'd be too obvious. They dug a big hole on the edge of the property, near the fence, then poured concrete over them so no one could get at the cartridges. Guess they were trying to protect their intellectual property. Even though the game was horrible, and no one at the time would buy them, they didn't want copies finding their way back onto the market. I guess the game had already done enough damage before they pulled it. But you already know that, otherwise you wouldn't be here. It's amazing how the worst game ever made got so much attention years later. Funny how it's always the extremes. If it's the worst, well, people want it, especially if it's rare."
Garth stopped on an exposed slab of concrete that extended out in all directions under a broken cover of sand and sagebrush.
"We've arrived," he proudly declared. "Imagine, we're standing on hundreds of thousands of game cartridges, but they're all 3 yards down under 18 inches of concrete. There's not much to see. Guess that's why this place never became a national attraction. You'd need X-ray vision to make it interesting. My guess is a simple plaque wouldn't have cut it."
Armin pulled a pair of stylish sunglasses out of her bag, put them on, then stared at the ground around her feet. After a few seconds, she looked up and said,
"Well, I'm satisfied. Thanks for bringing me here, Garth."
"You know, I didn't know that polarized sunglass lenses could penetrate concrete."
"They can't,"
she noted with a wry smile. Garth looked confused.
"What'd you say that paper was about that you wrote in university?"
"The gaming industry crash in 83. The stuff buried here was ground zero. There's a lot of folklore about this site. I guess I just needed to see it for myself. Make sure that there weren't any 8-bit ghosts haunting the burial."
Armin tried to act disappointed, but her eyes were excitedly dancing around the sight. Garth gave her a look that said, "I don't believe you."
"You know, Orman, over the years I've been here, a lot of people who have claimed to be disinterested have come back out here and tried to break through this concrete, but failed."
To make his point, he tapped a foot on the ground. Orman suddenly looked up and shaded her eyes, scanning the horizon, squinting.
"There's someone over there on the low rise. Don't stare. Crouching beside an ATV. They've been watching us since we've arrived. Is it a friend of yours?"
"I didn't tell anyone that I was bringing you out here."
"Maybe we should go then,"
Orman suggested, discreetly dropping a small object that looked like a pebble by her feet. As they walked back to Garth's car, they both noticed the figure tracking them.
"I can drop you at your hotel,"
Garth suggested, unable to hide his concern.
"No thanks. Just somewhere downtown. Anywhere will do."
"Are you sure?" As usual, the stranger left after Orman finished her cover of Suspicious Minds. She sang the last four songs in her set, then checked the time. 12:50 a.m. That gave her a little more than 6 hours of total darkness to complete what she needed to do. And if all went well, Orman would be leaving Orbit City, New Mexico, the country, and the continent for the last time. It had taken far too long to find the exact spot. Months had turned into years of planning, years of jumping around the country. Thinking about it made Orman suddenly feel exhausted. For a brief moment, she considered just walking out of the bar and going straight to the landfill, the fastest way at her disposal, not caring if anyone saw her for what she really was. But instead, she reluctantly fell back into the routine, packed up her gear, then with the help of the bar's staff, lugged it out to her leased car. Perhaps that's why she didn't notice the beat-up 4x4 with its lights out, following her through the city to the motel, where it patiently waited for her to check out. Orman turned south onto Highway 54, carefully observing the local speed limit. Although she was in a hurry, she couldn't risk drawing attention to herself. A simple speeding ticket could wreck everything. The sparse traffic dwindled almost to nothing as she reached the edge of town. She checked the rearview mirror and noticed a pair of headlights half a block behind. Nervously, Orman slowed at the next intersection, which was marked by a set of traffic lights set to flashing red. She signaled to turn, and the lights behind her grew until an old pickup truck pulled around and passed. With relief, she loosened her grip on the steering wheel, then pulled off onto the side road. She sat for a moment, her heart pounding, and found herself focused on the steering wheel. It was like everything else around her, odd, crudely made, a cross between function and fashion, with the vehicle's manufacturer's logo needlessly emblazoned across its center. To what end? She didn't understand. To remind the driver of what type of car they were in? Orman finally had to admit, she'd never understand this culture. But what did that really matter anymore? She swiveled against her seatbelt to check that there were no headlights in either direction, then pulled back out onto the highway. 5 minutes later, Orman was at the turnoff for the landfill. She checked around again, and spotting no one, Orman cut the lights, then swung into the old rutted road. It took no time for her eyes to adjust. After all, she had lived most of her life in a place where it was dark half the year. In fact, Orman could see better now than in daylight. Almost immediately, the car began to complain about the road, issuing metallic groans as it bounced through the ruts. She slowed down, but kept going. She only needed the car to convey her to the site. It didn't matter if the thing was wrecked in the process. She wouldn't need it to leave the landfill. Trying to make as little noise as possible, Orman wove the car along the trail. Once she had passed the garbage mounds, Orman stopped and got out, listening for the locator she had dropped on the ground that afternoon. At first, she couldn't hear it over the soft sound of the wind that swept down from the mountains, carrying the ever-present smell of burning brush. But as she adjusted her hearing to filter out the breeze, she could just make out the locator's low whisper. Orman detuned her hearing to listen for movement around her. Off in the old garbage dump mounds, she could pick out some type of burrowing animal, enthusiastically digging, but nothing else. So she quietly got back into her car
and drove slowly to the spot the locator had marked. Once there, she opened the trunk and pulled out one of her musical instrument cases. Garth hid behind the husk of an old discarded washing machine, watching Orman through the army surplus night vision goggles he had borrowed along with the old 4x4 from a friend. Arriving barely 5 minutes before her, he had just finished hiding the truck and had found a safe place to watch from when Garth heard the car. He had quickly realized that she wasn't like any of the other fanatics, who occasionally made the pilgrimage to the dump site in hopes of picking up some memorabilia that they could sell or keep to impress their friends. Most were disappointed when Garth showed them the site and pointed out that the treasure lay 12 feet down under a thick layer of concrete. But that hadn't fazed Orman in the least. If anything, she could barely conceal her excitement. And then there was her music. It really wasn't that good. All the notes were correct. But it was as if Orman wasn't listening, like she was asleep as she played. Even before the end of the first song, Garth had concluded that Orman wasn't a musician. And that had perked his interest. That was why he had offered to bring her out here, then followed her back in the middle of the night. He watched as she pulled an unrecognizable device from a beat-up instrument case and slung it over her shoulder. Next, Orman stooped down, looking almost as if she was talking to someone, and picked up a pebble off the ground. She looked around, then got up and quickly walked to a spot a few yards from the car. She took the device off her shoulder, hesitated, then extended 3 thin legs from the mysterious apparatus. Orman held the legs out in front of her as if she was divining for water, then slowly moved the apparatus around until the legs began to bend down. She immediately planted the machine at that spot. A beam of silent pink light instantly shot down between the device's legs into the cracked concrete. Orman started to gesture in the air, then suddenly lifted one of her hands up, and the crushed box appeared on the ground. Orman turned the mechanism off, and the pink light evaporated. She bent down and inspected the box, pulling a cartridge out, reverently rolling it over in her hand. Garth was trying to make sense of what he had just witnessed, when a glow seemed to sweep across the dump to envelop Orman. Orman gently held one of the plastic cartridges in her hand, rolling it over, letting her nerves confirm that its precious content was still preserved in its ungainly primitive circuits. But before she could read them, a glowing figure emerged out of the night, grasped her by the arm and twisted, making her drop it.
"Who are you? Let me go,"
Orman demanded, shaking her arm in an attempt to free herself.
"There's no way that's ever going to happen. People laughed at me for almost 40 years, but now I've finally caught one of you. They won't laugh anymore."
An older man, dressed head to foot in a yellow biohazard suit, stepped around in front of Orman.
"Not in a million years are you going to get away. You're my proof."
"Proof of what?"
"Proof that you exist. Proof that aliens are behind all video games."
The man was starting to become visibly agitated.
"Come on, some of us figured it out right away. Bet you didn't know that. Bet you think that we're so primitive that we wouldn't catch on that video games are a form of conditioning, and that you're preparing us for an eventual takeover."
"Oh, come on. You've got to be kidding me. You've been following me around because you think I'm an alien? Really, that takes the cake."
"Your agents infiltrated our entertainment industries over 100 years ago. That's well known in my circles. But they failed their mission objectives, didn't they? Until they hit on gaming, that is. Well, more accurately, invented the gaming industry, and most likely introduced the integrated circuit to help it happen."
"You're deluded, or crazy, or both. I'm just a musician with an interest in video game history,"
Orman pleaded, and fought to break free, but the man gripped her even harder, pulling a pair of handcuffs out of one pocket with his free hand.
"And that thing," the man nodded toward the 3-legged device, "is no musical instrument."
Orman sighed as the man triumphantly clamped one end of the handcuffs to her captured wrist.
"It's just an underground imager,"
she insisted.
"I borrowed it from a friend who's a geologist."
"Yeah, from another planet. And your friend has 6 eyes.
Suddenly, there was a noise, and her assailant stiffened, dropping his end of the handcuffs and raising his arms in the air, like a bad guy in an old cowboy movie.
Good, that's more like it. Now carefully take the handcuffs off of her.
Orman immediately recognized the voice. It was Garth. She was both relieved and dismayed. The man in the biohazard suit did as he was told, letting the handcuffs drop onto the ground.
"You're helping the wrong side, mister," the man screamed. "They're slowly taking over the world. She's the proof. You can't let her go."
Garth stepped around the man, pointing a plastic ray gun at him. The suited figure groaned and dropped his hands.
"I found it on the ground on the way in. I collect old space toys," Garth explained. "You had that look this afternoon, Orman. I've seen it before in the eyes of other game fanatics. It told me that you couldn't resist. So I followed you. That truck that passed me,"
Orman mumbled.
"I was curious," Garth continued. "The more organized people have rented small backholes. Others have posthole diggers, and the really deluded ones have simply brought a shovel. But you've upped the ante. What is that thing, and how did it manage to extract that box?"
Orman instinctively bent down and picked up the cartridge she had dropped earlier on the ground.
"It's just a new type of underground imaging device. I borrowed it. I only noticed the box lying there after I turned it on."
Garth looked unconvinced.
"All the easy-to-find cartridges were scooped up years ago, Orman."
"Well, I guess that the box must have just been buried under the sand, and the wind this evening exposed it."
"She's got a spaceship, mister. I've seen it," the man in the bile suit shouted. "I followed her to her motel last night, and she walked straight through the lobby and out into the field behind. When she thought no one was looking, she called it down from the sky. I tried to take a picture, but my camera didn't work."
Garth turned to Orman for an explanation, and she gave him an impatient sigh.
"Cameras, audio recorders, whatever. We disable them all within a 10-mile radius."
"I wouldn't joke about things like that around a guy like this, Orman. He could be dangerous."
"Maybe, Garth, but he's right. I'm not from this world. I'm not here to take over your ratty little planet either. In fact, I can hardly wait to get off it. I was sent to collect one of these."
She held out the game cartridge, the letters running across its tattered label read, AT, an alien adventure.
"When I left home, these had just been released. We saw them in ads in your TV signals."
"That would put you about..."
"About 21.5 light years away, but that's irrelevant. Once we'd figured out the gameplay, the story it told was too similar to the fable of our ancient leader to be a coincidence. Over the years, a few of our agents have gone missing in the solar system, so we knew it had to be one of them that made it."
"See?"
the man in the biohazard suit frantically exclaimed, then bent down to pick up the handcuffs. Orman turned and stared at him. He instantly froze, then fell down onto the ground in a motionless heap.
"He'll wake up tomorrow with a headache and wonder why he's out here. He'll probably think that he was abducted by aliens. And I guess in a way that's true."
She laughed. Garth instinctively backed away.
"I'm not going to do that to you, Garth. Let me explain. The story this cartridge is based on is protected under copyright law, and it was never licensed to use in a game. Our people are very particular about stuff like that. So I was sent here to collect evidence against the offender, the game creator, whom a colleague is picking up right now. I suspect he got cold feet, and that's why all the copies were buried. It makes sense that most humans didn't like the game."
"Why?"
"Well, Garth, we're aliens. We don't understand enough about humans to make games for you."
"Or play our music," Garth sarcastically added.
"Oh yeah, that too. Our sensibilities are very different. But I bet AT would have been a hit back home. Too bad about the copyright infringement."
He stood, holding the toy ray gun. He had moved his arm so the thing was now pointing at her. "Hands up."
"Okay, you've got me, Garth,"
she laughed.
"But before you take me in, I want to give you a choice. You told me that you came to Orbit City because it would be the closest you'd ever get to space. So here's your chance."
Orman held out her hand.
"Let's go."
Thanks
for listening to Makeshift Stories 81, An Alien Adventure. We hope that you've enjoyed this month's episode. As always, if you like what we're doing, please tell your friends about us, or write a review on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, or check us out in Google+ or Facebook. We love hearing your comments, so send us an email to makeshiftstories@gmail.com or visit our website at makeshiftstories.com. We release a new story every month between the 15th and the 20th. To listen to Makeshift Stories on your iOS or Android device, please download Stitcher Radio from iTunes or the Google Play Store. This month's episode was written and read by Alan B. Hare. The opening and closing theme is Pod Safe Music by David Hume. Makeshift Stories is released under a Creative Commons non-commercial attribution, no derivative license, which means that you're free to share our stories. Just remember to credit us and don't alter anything.